From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made in the fine print, the details of the new congressional tax plan that cruised through the House and has gained more support in the Republican-led Senate. On this program earlier this month, Congressman Tom Reed said the bill would be a big victory for the middle class and for hardworking Americans who populate his district. He said that the average family would save $1,600 in this bill, even though that almost every nonpartisan analysis says the actual savings are nowhere near that much, and in the long run, some hardworking Americans will actually pay more. One of the big questions looming over this bill is the impact on education and on graduate students. A provision of the bill could force grad students to pay thousands of dollars more, which could make their higher education unaffordable. One university administrator told NPR that this bill represents the most serious threat to doctoral education in this country ever. And yesterday in Rochester, a bipartisan group of town supervisors and mayors stood against the tax plan, saying that it would hurt the middle class. So this hour, a conversation about the possible impacts. We'll try to address questions and comments as you have them as well. My guests include Bill Maley, supervisor of the town of Brighton. Bill, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan. Great to be here.
Also here is Scott O'Neill. He is a PhD candidate in English, studying Shakespearean drama and the history of professions, as one does. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Great to have you. Helen Davies is a PhD student in English, second-year student studying medieval literature and digital humanities. Welcome to you as well, Helen.
Thank you so much.
And by the way, PhD students where, Helen and Scott?
The University of Rochester.
Same.
Okay, just want to make sure because I didn't introduce that. Thanks again for being here. What I want to start by doing, to be fair here, is to play a short recap of the conversation I had with Congressman Tom Reed, a Republican who said he's going to enthusiastically support this bill and has been doing so. So here he was just sort of giving us the broad outline for how he thinks there could be an impact for people in his district.
We're looking at real relief for hardworking taxpayers back home to the tune of $1,600 for the average family. In our district alone.
$1,600, but let's say you had 10 taxpayers in your district and one of them got $91,000 in tax cuts, the other nine got $1,000. You could then claim that the average taxpayer in your district gets $10,000, even though 9 out of 10 get nowhere close to that. And that's what the Tax Policy Center says. They're pointing out that the average family in your district gets something like $300, not $1,600.
That's absolutely false. If you run the numbers and if you can do a rough calculation and you look at what we're doing with the new tax brackets, you look at how we're expanding the standard deduction. What I'm looking at is a typical family making around $40,000, which is somewhat the average salary in our district. That is the relief they'll see at the bottom line in their tax liability from last year's taxes to the future year's taxes once tax reform is enacted.
How much should we expect the top 1% and the top 0.1% to benefit from this plan?
You know, as you saw, and I was an advocate, when you saw the 39.6 rate be placed on the books, and then you saw the bubble rate of 44% put on the books as part of the House tax proposal. I'm not fighting this fight for the wealthy 1%. I'm fighting this fight for the hardworking taxpayers. And when you see that type of rate, when you see that type of bubble effect, I think that should be a clear indication to all Americans what we're trying to do. It's not take care of the wealthy, not take care of the 1%. We're trying to give relief and target it to those hardworking Americans right in the middle.
The Congressional Budget Office says this bill would add $1.7 trillion to the national debt over the next decade. How are you going to pay for it?
Well, you know, this is where that was a hard decision to make. And obviously, that's a significant amount added to the debt, and I'm concerned about that. But I do believe that one of the solutions to our debt problem is growth, and this is going to spur growth.
Congressman, when you talk about spurring growth, historically, I mean, if the tax rate is 90% and you cut it from 90 to 50, historically you've seen that can have an impact. But where the rates are now, anywhere up to 39.6 or 8%, we have not seen for the last three decades plus any evidence that tax cuts like this spur enough growth to come anywhere close to covering that sort of magical thinking. Why are we still doing that?
Well, I'm of the mindset if you grow the economy, obviously long term, you're going to have significant growth for decades. And that is going to be a cornerstone or a piece of the solution.
Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, are you going to target those?
We have been a supporter of Medicaid reform, for example, just as recently as the recent health care debate. We need to get Medicaid going in the right direction. We need to reward efficiency and quality as opposed to a fee-for-service type model. And that type of health care conversation, I think, would take care of a lot in regards to Medicaid and Medicare spending. And I think a lot of people would agree.
All right, that's Congressman Tom Reed earlier this month on this program. So just to kind of summarize, he thinks that the nonpartisan, not partisan, but nonpartisan analysis from many different quarters, including the Tax Policy Center, is just wrong about the bill. He thinks that the history in the last three decades of tax cuts, especially at the top levels, leading to growth that can spark the kind of growth to sort of jumpstart the economy and cover the cost. He thinks it's happened. The evidence says it has not. And I'm not trying to be partisan. I'm just trying to look at evidence here with the congressman. I asked him about paying for it in other ways, spending cuts, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. And his response was Medicaid's going to be looked at. So that's where things stand from the GOP perspective. And now let's talk to our guests about what their thoughts are about the bill. Bill Maley, supervisor of the town of Brighton, was with the group of, well, a bunch of mayors and supervisors yesterday.
That's right.
Raising concerns about what specifically, Bill? You just heard the congressman. I know you know Tom Reed, right?
I do. In fact, Congressman Reed used to represent a good part of Brighton and obviously a good part of Monroe County.
Do you think he's just wrong here?
I do think he's just wrong. And I think some terminology is important. There have been references to this as tax reform. Tax reform. And we need tax reform. The tax code hasn't been fully overhauled since 1986. But tax reform is a process. It is a bipartisan process. It's a process that involves hearings. It's a process that involves an analysis of sort of the puts and takes. And none of that has happened here. This has been a process that, you know, we just saw just this week, senators literally, their votes being purchased by promises of benefits to presumably very wealthy, you know, this corporate pass-through exemption that Senator Johnson was looking for to get his vote. That's not tax reform. The Syracuse Post-Standard today has just suggested that 86% of the top 1% of taxpayers will get their taxes reduced. So to say that this is not a tax bill for the benefit of the very, very rich really misunderstands the bill. I think your analysis is very good. But it's going to hurt us very badly in this region. We're going to talk about education today. This region, the Rochester region, our economy is driven in large part by education. And that's certainly true in Brighton. A tax bill that hurts education, as this higher education, as this bill would, is going to be very bad for this region, and frankly, very bad for a lot of the people that Congressman Reed represents.
Bill, a couple of things, and we're going to turn to our other guests, and we'll also take your phone calls this hour if you want to join the program. And let us know what you think of these proposals going through Congress now. So a couple things, Bill. When it comes to the evidence and the research, and again, I'm going back to the Reagan era forward, most of the time when there are tax cuts of this level, we don't see a surge in hiring. We don't see this explosion in growth that the congressman talked about. Essentially, what the people who even worked, some of them worked with Ronald Reagan or with the Heritage Foundation at the time, people like Bruce Bart, let's say, is the wealthiest will just keep more money. And I don't mean to be crass about that. I mean, some people think that's fine, that they paid the most in taxes. But what the Tax Policy Center says here is if you're in that top 1%, you're getting tax cuts in this bill to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars, $70,000, $100,000 less on your tax bill. You're not going to go out and hire a bunch of people. You're not going to go out and change the economy overnight. You're probably just keeping more money. Is that your feeling on that?
Well, that's certainly what the evidence suggests, and even anecdotally as this process has been going through. That's been clearly the reaction that this is, although there have been claims that it goes into hiring, the reality is no, that's not where it goes through. It can... It does fall into the pockets.
But why can't they just keep more money then? Even if they don't want to do anything with it for people. What if they want to buy another yacht? Shouldn't they be allowed to?
Well, the impact, all of these assumptions that somehow magically, as you said, these dramatic tax cuts are going to be paid for by leveraging economic growth don't happen. They cannot happen if they simply go into the pocket. Theoretically, they could happen if there was more hiring and more production. But what we're seeing, you know, the U.S. economy has grown slowly most of the time. We've had some recessions. But the population isn't growing to the point, I mean, the demand drives new production. And it's hard to imagine that this much of an instant bump in tax breaks for these multi-billion dollar corporations is quickly going to go into new facilities. They take years to plan, and they're scoped out in terms of, will they have an impact? Is there enough demand for their widget to support that? And in the meantime, they don't leverage the economy. They will not cause tax growth. I mean, and this region in particular, you know, we've heard yesterday our press conference was really to focus on the impact of eliminating or dramatically reducing the ability of New York taxpayers to take deductions for local property taxes and for state income taxes. The commentators on all sides of the political spectrum have indicated that eliminating those deductions will hurt the U.S. And specifically the New York economy. I mean, E.J. McMahon from the Empire Center indicated that home values in upstate New York could fall by as much as 20%. That would have a leverage, and it would be a vicious cycle that would reduce middle-class taxpayers' wealth. It would reduce the tax base of municipalities like ours, forcing us to look at either potentially significant tax increases or equally significant cuts in services, neither one of which would be helpful to the quality of life.
And again, the analysis he just cited, not E.J. Dionne, quite liberal, but E.J. McMahon from the Empire Center, not nearly as liberal.
So. And you know, and I think one other thing that hasn't gotten a lot of notice, you know, there's supporters of the tax bill will say, oh yes, but the limit, you know, the standard deduction will go up. And yes, it would go up in these proposals. But what hasn't been talked about a lot is that the personal exemptions that individuals, and particularly people who file as heads of households, single parents of children, would be eliminated. So for many families, and many middle-class families and lower-income families, losing that exemption would offset, or worse, any benefits from the standard deduction going up.
All right, we've heard a lot about how this could impact grad students. Helen Davies is a PhD student, a second-year PhD student at the University of Rochester. So Helen, your read of this bill means it could impact you how?
It would mean that graduate school would become basically unaffordable for me. Right now, our stipend is $18,000 a year. If the House version of this bill passes, not the Senate bill, but the House bill goes forward, then it would include a new law that says that our tuition waivers can be taxed as if they were income. Now, we never see a drop of this money. This does not go in or out of our pockets at any point. And the tuition waiver at the University of Rochester is $51,000. So I would be taxed as if I made about $70,000 a year, which is significantly more than I make at $18,000 a year. So I make $18,000 a year. The $10,000 I would now pay in tax would mean that, sorry, it would now be $8,300 okay. I pay in tax. And that would mean that I have $9,700 to live on, plus another $400 in state tax I'd have to pay. So I'd be living off of $9,300 a year. That's not feasible.
So if the House version passes, it is an increase in taxes to you of almost $9,000 annually.
Absolutely.
Can't afford it. Are you done with your PhD pursuit?
I think I would have to be, and I think a significant other portion of PhD students would have to be, which would have a drastic impact on the state of higher education as we know it, both in the humanities and in the sciences.
What are your peers saying about this?
I do not know of a single PhD student in my year that would be able to continue on as a PhD student after this tax bill goes forward in this current state.
Wow. And well, what about the argument that some might have to say, well, okay, you are not seeing any money go into your pocket or out, but they're going to tax you as if you were because there's value in your PhD studies, right? So they're taxing you on a value received, no?
There's a way of looking at it in that regards. But for our PhD, we are required to provide service to the university. So we are working full-time as PhD students, and either as a teaching assistant or as a research assistant for a professor every year after the first year generally. So we are already making money for the university or providing services for the university that further the state of education. So yes, there is value in our education for ourselves, but we are also contributing back to the university as well. So
you're not seeing the fairness there.
Correct.
It sounds like.
Well, it goes to part of the issue of being a grad student, where we kind of exist in that phantom zone between being employees and being students. And so it's, on the one hand, we teach classes, we work jobs that students would not be allowed to do. But on the other hand, we're also kind of students who, at least in part of the program, take classes. I think most of, for a decent chunk of graduate education, you know, it's almost the equivalent of when a doctor does a residency, where there's a sense of training involved, but they're also doing the job at the same time. And so I don't think anyone would try and, you know, add med school tuition rates to what a medical resident would make and tax them at that rate.
I think on the subject of grad students, Tom in Rochester on the phone wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Tom.
I was going to make that point. It what it boils down to on the tuition issue is it's a taxing out of an employee benefit. So if we're going to tax that benefit, why don't we attack benefits such as country club dues for executives, or why not tax healthcare benefits? Those are enormous amounts of money. The search is on to cover the bill for the tax cut. And tax fairness also is about the ability to pay tax as a percentage of your total income. Someone making $1 million pays a lower total percentage of tax than someone making $75,000 or $100,000. The percentages are not aligned fairly. There's certainly a different way to do this, and I think that the gentleman earlier in the call and many senators on both sides of the aisle have said, how can we do this without hearings? And the answer is simple. You have to do it without hearings, because when the truth is widely promulgated, everyone will realize it's a gift to people in the nine-figure club. Everyone knows it, including Mr. Reed, who will vote for it. Because if you don't vote for it, your donors won't give you money. That's what Mr. Collins said. He has no choice. I have to vote for it or the donors will cut me off. Well, there you go. So that's my comment. Thank you.
Tom, thanks for the phone call. Some thoughts from the panel on that.
Bill Maley? The last caller talked about fairness and you know, here with two graduate students, personalizes it. But the fairness issue, education has long been one of the great equalizers in our society. What this will do, particularly for, as you indicated, first-generation families, other families of limited means, it will make it that much more difficult for those children to get the education that has been the equalizer in our country in so many ways. So the fairness issue pervades this whole tax bill, and unfortunately in a very negative way.
All right, before I get our next phone call, let me ask our other guest to weigh in. Helen, what do you make of that?
I think as a further point to the equalizing thing is that not only does it affect graduate students directly, but as graduate students, we are expected to do things like teach writing 101, like composition classes. And so if education is the great equalizer, it's not only the great equalizer for us, but also for the undergraduates that we get to work with every single day.
Okay.
They both kind of made points that I would have made. I'm a first generation sort of doctoral student, and it's you don't see too many people from similar backgrounds from farm towns. Helen and I have a shared friend who I poke fun of all the time because he tucks in flannel, and coming from farm country, it's like, you don't tuck in flannel. But it's a lot of people you see in higher education aren't really from that background. And I think we would lose the handful that we do have now just from being priced out.
Before I get back to the phone calls, these personal stories are examples of possible impacts. Now, Scott, you're further along,
right.
So you're going to finish. Could this bill impact you in any way that you could see in terms of, you know, your future career pursuit then?
Well, I think it's going to have significant impacts on the field of education, higher education as a whole, because a lot of the structure of the way that schools pay for higher education is based on sort of having a group of PhD holding people that teach classes. And when you significantly restrict the people that are able to pursue that, they're not going to be able to put enough people in front of classes. It will, you know, schools will be shutting down. You know, people, we're not going to get international students in nearly the same rates that we do now, which is a huge boom to our economy and just the intellectual capital of the country. We're going to lose our competitive edge in a great many areas. And so it's going to have a long-term effect on the market as a whole, in addition to just grad students.
Okay. And Helen, for you, though, you're not nearly as far along. So just briefly, give me a snapshot of what you think a good career path could be for you right now and how that could actually change here if this goes through.
Well, I mean, the ideal career path for any PhD student, specifically in the humanities, is always to work as a faculty member at another university upon graduating and be able to continue our research and be able to continue teaching and passing on the love of literature or whatever your subject may be to the future generations. However, if that happens, if this tax bill goes through in this current form, that won't be an option for me. I won't be able to get to the point where I can complete my PhD, which is a requirement for this sort of work. It would be completely cut off for me.
And you'll do what? I mean, I guess figure out something else.
Yeah, I would have to completely change the career that I have been working to. I mean, I've been in graduate school now. I did two masters before this, and I'm in my second year of my PhD. So I've been taking grad school classes on and off for 6 years now. And I'd have to throw all of that work away and find a completely different career path.
And Helen relocated as well to follow a mentor. And so she moved to a completely different part of the country to pursue this. And it's, you know, I left a tenured high school teaching position to pursue graduate school. And it's not like we were, you know, a handful that were told, oh, well, you won't have to, you'll get a special scholarship. It's just, there's no expectation. I had to look up what the tuition rate was because there was no expectation that we would ever have to pay tuition.
You basically do not pursue a PhD in the humanities if you're expected to pay tuition, because the job market being what it is for humanities PhDs, you're not guaranteed to get a career at the other side of this. And so to take out student loans or something to pay for such a degree would be not your wisest choice.
And PhD programs that charge tuition are seen as predatory.
All right, so let me go ahead and grab some more phone calls on these and other subjects related to the GOP tax plan. Joel in Rochester next. Go ahead, Joel.
I think your guest just touched on the fact that a lot of graduate students, in addition to when they can getting tuition waivers, also take out student loans from time to time. As a former or current, whatever the hell the right word is, as a PhD person, a person with a PhD, you know, there were plenty of times where I took out student loans in any given year or semester to, you know, make ends meet. Because what I was getting paid from the University of Minnesota in my case, wasn't enough, you know, every year to pay my rent, to pay various bills, and to feed myself and whatnot. So, you know, it's as if you're going to tax them not only on this tuition, but then in addition to that, you've got debt at the end because you're going to have student loans in many cases. So it's another way in which you're getting hit in multiple ways by the U.S. government.
Joel, thanks for the phone call. Helen, Scott, do you agree with what you're hearing there, Scott?
Definitely, and it reinforces a lot, especially for people in Helen's position and similar, where if this passes and they get priced out of finishing their degree, they're going to end up still owing on their student loans, which also the interest that from that won't be able to be deducted anymore. But they won't have the degree to show for it. And so it's not even like they can take the degree and go into an alternative field. They'll be priced out of even completing the degree while still being charged for the part that they did.
No degree, a lot of debt, starting over. That's possibly what Helen's looking at, and that's what we're hearing again. I mean, what I'm trying to present as the not expert in the room is what happens here if this bill passes. You heard Congressman Tom Reed earlier this hour. We did try to track down some of the response that his office and others in Congress have been having with this issue, and essentially what they keep coming back to is they believe $1,600 a year for the average family in the middle class. So Tom Reed's office said complaints coming into his office about the House tax bill have focused often on the loss of medical deductions, plans to eliminate student loan interest, and the taxing of graduate students waive tuition as income. But he maintained that doubling of the standard deduction to $24,000 and lower tax rates would mean an additional $1,600 a year would stay in the pockets of the average middle-class household in the 23rd congressional district. So, Bill, he's sticking to that. He believes that the overall that there's that yes, there are some places where these graduate students are going to suffer, but they're still going to come out ahead overall.
Well, I think, as you pointed out earlier, objective nonpartisan commentators disagree for a lot of reasons. One of them, again, is that personal exemption that goes away that will have a devastating impact on large numbers of middle class, particularly single parent families. Again, going back to the growth notion, that can work both ways. The Rochester area economy is dominated by higher education. It is our economic driver, and that's particularly true in Brighton. We have a major component of the U of R, two MCC campuses, both their main campus and their Applied Technology Center. RIT is right on our doorstep. If those universities, by all of these factors, and there are others, the tax bill has a tax on endowments that people haven't quite been able to figure out why it's in there, but it's certainly not going back help lower-income people get an education.
Well, a couple of things there. We're going to have a whole discussion on a separate day about what university endowments are and are not, because everyone from our conservative listeners to Malcolm Gladwell get outraged when they see that Princeton has a $22 billion endowment. University of Rochester has a $2 billion-plus endowment. And I'm not entirely sure how they work. And I can't sit here and tell you, but we're going to work on that. We're going to answer some questions.
And if, in fact, the tax that they're imposing was going to be used, for example, to make education more affordable at a wide variety of schools, that is why I believe they maintain the endowment, or at least part. But it's not. There is no program that money, it is being used to fund these tax breaks that all objective commentators indicate will go to the very wealthy. But when higher education in Rochester, and it will be impacted, it will have a multiplier and a negative effect on the region's economy as a whole.
Mr. Supervisor, I think some of our conservative listeners would argue that while you're correct to say the U of R is now the largest regional employer, obviously supplanting the Codex long ago, the Codex of the world long ago, that the goal would be to get back to the point where higher ed is not the largest employer. They want to see whether it's manufacturing or other industries thrive, and that reducing the corporate tax rate from 35 to 20 could maybe push us there. Again, I'm just responding and helping parrot some of what we're hearing from conservatives who want this to pass.
Well, there's no question that an economy that is based just on tax-exempt institutions like hospitals and universities is vulnerable, and manufacturing jobs, certainly the Rochester area, whether it was Kodak or many of our other manufacturing businesses that were here and important, helped make Rochester what it is today. But we don't have a magic switch to make that happen. And one of the ways that happens is by training people. Programs like MCC's Advanced Technology Program work with employers, train people in the kind of tool and die technology middle jobs that will be important to a future manufacturing base in our community. But until that time, if we, when you eat your seed corn, you don't have a harvest the next year. And that's what I'm afraid we're doing here.
Helen?
To piggyback off of that, the training aspect of that would be critical to this discussion, I believe. If you have grad students that can't, if you can't have an educational system that can help fund grad students, then you're losing an aspect of your future employees, whether it is chemical engineers that need the higher degree to understand fully the processes that they're working on, or whether it's the MBA students that can help make the smart financial decisions, or whether it's the humanities students that help go, maybe we shouldn't clone a dinosaur, or something along those lines. Like, you're losing a lot of people that can contribute to these other industries. One of the other aspects of this tax bill that directly impacts graduate students and undergraduates is that your employers are no longer going to be able to provide the same kind of tax exemption for tuition. So for right now, if your employer wants to be like, oh, you're a promising employee, let me help move you up in the ranks for your company because I can see how you can continue to contribute to this. They can offer a tuition-reduced MBA, for example, at the U of R. And if you could pursue this, then you can move up not only within your own company, but your company obviously benefits from you having this increased expertise. And you would lose that. So you would hinder some of your local industries in that way as well.
All right, here's an email from Carol who says, "Hi, Evan. Our son is a PhD student in Colorado in atmospheric chemistry. This tax will greatly impact him in continuing studying. Plus, his program is being attacked by the lack of respect for climate change. His professors are deeply concerned about funding. This is a very sad time." That's from Carol. But for another side of this, let's go to Fairport, and this is Robert on the phone. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for my call. There's really absolutely nothing to stop the University of Rochester, which has an endowment of over $2 billion, or any other academic institution from just paying these graduate students more money. I mean, if you look at the way this benefit is structured, you could say that this is a loophole that probably should have been closed a long time ago. Tuition is a cash item that if you're getting it waived, there is a cash value for that, and that cash value probably should be taxable. The other thing that hasn't been mentioned here is that the major crux of this tax bill is to cut the corporate tax rate from in the 30s to down, I think, 20%.
35 to 20.
The U.S. has the highest corporate tax rate in the world. I mean, how can you be competitive with a situation like that?
Okay. Well, Robert, thanks for this. And let me start with Helen, who had a pretty visceral reaction to the idea that let's take that endowment and let's pay the grad students.
I mean, that would be lovely if we'd pay the grad students
more. You got $2 billion sitting there in a pile, Scrooge McDuck style. Just grab some of that.
So I'm not sure about the restrictions for private universities like the U of R, but RIT also has, I looked it up this morning, 3,222 grad students, according to their website, and they're a state school. So then if you are a state or a public institution, you are governed by state laws. And there are a heck of a lot more restrictions on how you can mess with the tuition for grad students. So, you know, the U of R may have a $2 billion endowment. I do not believe that most state-funded public universities would have the same option. So then, you know, even if we go that route, you start to skew the educational environments by only going through private universities.
Okay. Scott, you want to add to that? Go ahead.
Definitely, because it's a part of it is based on flawed logic. It's the idea that a lot of people think that everyone involved with the university is, you know, insanely liberal, but just to give a brief sort of indication, I had worked as an adjunct online teaching online writing classes for a school I will not name in the state of Delaware, and they charged students, you know, a reasonable tuition rate, but their whole model was that they were hiring only adjuncts. And so every class I taught, I was paid just under $2,000 per class. They made that much per student, and there were about 25 students. They had no full-time faculty. They basically exploited every employee they had, and their administrator, the university president at that school, was the 10th highest paid university president in the country, making almost $3 million. And so when you want to say, oh, well, they should be doing this, and so let's pass this thing that hurts the grad students, they're not going to do that. If you want to reform the way an administration works or the bureaucracy works, aim at that, because right now it's like, well, let's cut funds to this group, but they're not going to cut what they pay themselves. They're just going to try and scrimp and save more.
All right, on the other side of that, Robert mentioned the corporate tax rate. NPR confirms the U.S. does have the highest corporate tax rate among advanced economies. And according to the right-leaning Tax Foundation, the U.S. comes in third out of 188 behind the United Arab Emirates, and if you counted Puerto Rico separately. But essentially, the U.S. does have right there at the highest corporate tax rate. And Bill Maley, why not cut it from 35 to 20 then? If that's that, Republicans, I can hear them saying, thank you, NPR, for confirming that. So let's cut it.
Well, you know, 35 to 20% obviously is a very dramatic increase.
To grease the skids for hiring.
Well, if that were true, I mean, but again, I go back to what I said at the beginning. If this were real tax reform, this would be done in a systematic process with hearings. Instead, they're throwing around these numbers. Well, we could go from 20 to 22 if we do this with the child tax credit. This process is not driven by any real sense of trying to increase investment. it's they're trying to fill the hole that they're digging by giving very, very large tax breaks to very, very wealthy individuals. So I do think we ought to look very seriously at the tax rates that are that corporations pay and address that in the context of real overall tax reform. But that's not what this process is.
All right, I'm way late for our only break, so what I want to do is I want to get Meg and Sam on the phone. We'll get your comments when we come back here on the phones. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the GOP tax plan, which is gaining steam in the Senate. And our guests, you just heard Bill Maley, supervisor of the town of Brighton. Helen Davies and Scott O'Neill are PhD students, and we are talking about impacts from a wide range of angles of this potential tax plan that looks set to get through, but we'll see. So let's get our only break of the hour and come back to your phone calls next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on the Next Connections. In his book, Reinventing America's Schools, author David Osborne argues that we should treat every public school like a charter school, with an emphasis on diversity in school design and parental choice. He joins us to discuss the future of education from his perspective. In our second hour, about 150,000 people in our country are infected with the HIV virus, but don't know it. We'll discuss new research and treatment. That's Friday on Connections. All right, welcome back to Connections. I want to add just a little bit more context from NPR on this the subject of U.S. corporate taxation. NPR reports that the U.S. has the highest top corporate tax rate, at least among advanced economies. But the U.S. corporate taxation isn't all that big compared with other countries. As of 2014, U.S. corporate tax revenues were at about 2.2% of the GDP. And the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is a group of highly developed countries, the average was 2.8% of GDP. So the U.S. comes in less than the average if you look at the measure that way. I'm going to get back to your phones, phone calls, and Meg in Rochester next up. Go ahead, Meg.
Hi. I just wanted to add the perspective of a college professor who, obviously, I completed my PhD quite a few years ago, and I did benefit, obviously, from tuition benefits to be able to do that without debt. But now that I'm a college professor, one of the benefits, and I work at a small private college, and the pay is not high. We do not have a huge endowment. And one of the benefits we get as professors is the tuition benefit for our children. And this frightens me a little bit because I'm counting on that tuition benefit because my income, you know, my salary isn't incredibly high. So to have to claim, you know, I have two children, if I have to claim their tuition, if they end up going here, to my income, I think that has a significant effect on me as well. As you know, many of us spent 10 plus years in college, you know, in higher education, and we take, you know, a pay because we love what we do and we want to work at the college level. You know, the pay is not, you know, enormous, and so we take that knowing that one of the benefits we get is tuition benefits for our children and our spouses, but that's not in my case. But so I was just curious to throw that into the, you know, you were talking about how it would affect PhD students later on, and I'm that later on.
Okay. Well, thanks very, very much, Meg. Some thoughts from the panel.
Well, that's another example of what, you know, tax policymakers would talk about as phantom income. I mean, it's non-cash income, and yet you're asking people to pay cash taxes on that, and that creates a real challenge. It is a benefit, but it's a benefit that is very, very hard when it's non-cash to actually be able to pay cash taxes on.
Okay, Helen?
And I think that the last caller's point about taking a job at a university so that you can ensure that your children have access to that tuition benefit is a huge perk. My mother is a librarian at a university back home in Cincinnati, and she knows PhDs who have taken jobs as secretary at the university to ensure that their children can get a college education. I mean, we were talking earlier about how education was the great equalizer. We all want that that benefit, that perk, and people will do anything to get it. So to take that away from somebody is quite a shock.
All right, let me get back to the phones, and this is Sam in Rochester next. Go ahead, Sam.
Thank you, Evan, for taking my call. They was talking about this budget plan here, the tax plan benefiting the poor. So how is it going to benefit the poor when the money that was mandated for health insurance is now at the point where they say they're going to take it away and apply it to this budget. And if they apply it to this budget, the poor people that are working, if that gets taken away, the people that are working who are making $16,000, $18,000 a year, now they're going to have to pay for an insurance that they can't afford, and then that's going to, and then how are they going to pay like 30% tax at the end of the year? Because the other, the rich is only paying like 9%, 10%. Some of them are paying nothing when the poor people have to foot the bill for all the rest of it. And how is it that we have to pay the for them in the Senate and the Congress to have better health insurance than we have?
Well,
that to me is out of proportion.
All right, Sam, stay there. Bill Maley, I want to start with you on this because Sam is invoking health care, which listeners might be saying, wait, I thought this was a tax plan. But there are both things baked into this plan that impact different sectors of our economy and life, and also there are questions on how to pay for it. So you heard Congressman Tom Reed answer my question earlier when I said, you know, it's sort of evidence shows that it's kind of magical thinking to say that, well, growth will magically cover the cost of $1.5 trillion. It won't. So are you going to cut spending? Are you going to cut sort of the big targets, Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security? He didn't say we're going to cut Medicaid, but he responded by saying, yeah, Medicaid, we need to get more efficient. I mean, that sounds to me, Bill, like Medicaid cuts could be coming. And then the question becomes, you know, how does this work into healthcare reform separately? Are we going to go back down that road, et cetera? So what do you think?
Well, it certainly looks like they're trying to take us back down that road with the whole the Obamacare has re-emerged here. But Sam, of course, is absolutely right, and it goes back to what I said before. If what we were really trying to do is help the economy as a whole, reform our tax system, which needs reform, we would be looking at all of those things. We would have senators on the floor saying, I can't support this tax bill now, but if it was done in a way, if we change this and we address maybe the earned income credit or something else in a way that people at the lower end were also getting benefits, then the process would have more credibility. But Sam is absolutely right. The people at the low end, any benefit that they get is going to be very, very modest, not at all move the needle in terms of their quality of life. And what we're seeing is dramatic increases for, again, you know, the pass-through corporation issue. That was apparently the issue that got Senator Johnson's vote.
You want to explain that real quick, Bill?
Well, I haven't seen a lot of the details, but there are, to get into the weeds a little bit in corporate law, there are C corporations, S corporations, limited liability companies, different type of entities that are taxed in different ways. And what I think Senator Johnson is looking to do is make sure that all of those corporations and all of the particularly very wealthy, some of these corporations, a lot of small businesses are very small, but these benefits that they're talking about are benefits that would benefit business owners at the very, very high end. Like the estate tax, again, is another good example. You'll sometimes hear people talk about the estate tax, and the estate tax kills these small farmers and small businesses. You do not pay estate taxes unless you have, as a married couple, an estate of at least $11 million. There were only a couple of thousand estate tax returns filed in the whole country last year for families with very, very high income. This bill proposes to double that exemption from the estate tax, clearly skewed towards the very, very tip of the highest asset and income owners in the country.
All right, Sam, you want to follow up? Go ahead.
Yes, and just think about this. They're talking also about cutting the entitlement program. Now, just add that to it, where you're going to take away the mandate for the health insurance, then you're going to cut the entitlement program. And some people who are working, trying to make a living, are using some of those entitlement programs. So this is what's going to cause the very poor to just throw their hands up, get disgusted, quit working, and just say, you know, maybe I just go on the system, I'd be better off. Because you can't keep piling on me, and I may not survive, and I'm out there working every day trying to survive, but you keep piling on me, and I keep footing everybody else's bill, and then can't pay my own bill.
Well, Sam, thanks for the phone call. I know your sentiment has been reflected by a number of our listeners, and I want to thank Herman in Brighton for a couple of emails. Herman, first of all, reminds us of an important fact as we look at the sort of the reality behind the U.S. corporate tax rate. Again, among the highest, if not the highest, in the developed world, but a tax rate does not mean you are paying the full tax rate. Herman writes to say the nominal corporate tax rate is one of the highest, but the effective tax rate is more toward the middle of the pack, and that is the percentage of income that corporations actually pay after deductions and credits. And by the way, quite a few U.S. corporations pay little or no tax at all. Herman in Brighton. And he's
right about that.
He's right about that. So that is an important consideration. He also wants to ask a question. He says, can you give the audience suggestions as to the best way to influence the vote, which looks like it will be close on this bill? And Herman's pointing out, obviously, on the Senate level, there's two Democrats, they're going to be voting no. But Bill Maley, you know a lot of the people involved, and Republicans and Democrats. What would you tell Herman on that?
Well, you know, in New York, at least, there are Republicans. All of the Democrats, both in Congress and our two senators in New York, are going to be voting against the bill in anything close to the form that it's in now. There are some Republicans that have also voted against it or indicated that they're voting against it. But I think, I don't know. I mean, I wish I knew. I wish there was a magic bullet that was going to change minds on this. But people like Congressman Reed have a lot of people in their district that are in the kind of situations. He has institutions of higher education within his district. He has middle-class families who are going to be hurt very badly when local taxes are no longer deductible, when state income taxes are no longer deductible. 37% of the households in Monroe County deduct local property taxes. That's the middle class that you're talking about. And when they lose the ability to deduct, and that's true here, that's true in Congressman Reed, Congressman Conlon's district, I think they need to hear from people. I know they have. And frankly, for whatever reason, it hasn't changed their mind yet. But I think people have to continue reaching out, particularly in areas with wavering or undecided representatives in terms of how they're going to vote and why. Make it personal. I think there's nothing more powerful being here with the two students today and really being able to hear personal stories. I had a couple people reach out to me knowing that I was going to be on, talking about the impact on single heads of household of the personal exemption with a couple of children and the phase out of the head of household rate and moving people up to a single higher rate. All of those things, being able to convey how personally it will affect them, humanizing it. I hope there will be enough people on that side of the aisle that will listen.
All right, Joe in Fairport on the phone next. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on how the current tax plan that they're looking to roll out is really just a huge, enormous tax cut for a 1% of the population. And really what you're looking at is all the deductions that the middle class and affordable income lean on are going to get gutted from the student loan tax break that you can get for paying on interest for your student loans. When you're looking at the medical deduction, when you're looking at the state income tax deduction, all these deductions aren't for the 1%. These deductions are for the middle class, the affordable, people on fixed incomes. They're gone. And you look at what they say in the tax plan, well, the middle class and the lower class will get more money back on their tax return. But effectively, they'll be paying more taxes. So really, you're losing money in the end. So sure, I might get a little bit of a larger return, but I can no longer write off my student loans. Any medical bills cannot be written off. My state income cannot be written off. So I'm losing all my deductions as a middle-class person of this country, while you see people who are making millions, billions, wealthy people get to maintain all theirs, if not grow with it. So really, who is this tax plan for? It's not for anyone out there who works for a living, who pays their bills and does the best they can to support their families.
All right, Joe.
This is the tax plan written by the Koch brothers. Tax plan written by Donald Trump.
I got to let you go because I'm going to run out of time, Joe. Thanks. I take the point that you're not a fan. And, you know, as Bill Maley said, if you especially have lawmakers who are sort of on the edge on this, and you want it to pass, call them. And you don't want it to pass, call them. Your voice being heard, I don't know, Bill, I mean, you're an elected leader. People do listen when there is a large outcry.
Absolutely.
On either side.
Yes, for sure. Phone, email, whatever. You know, there's another, this region is going to be particularly hit. And, you know, there's so many little things in this bill, but the historic property tax credit is another one that is going to dramatically affect areas like upstate New York with a lot of older communities, with a lot of older buildings. Those buildings are being renovated in Rochester. There was just an awards luncheon 2 weeks ago recognizing some of those. If that historic property tax credit goes away, those buildings, which are beautiful and can be reused, preventing suburban sprawl, heightening the quality of life in the community, we're going to lose that. This tax bill would be a disaster for the Rochester area.
And you also heard Bill earlier in this hour invoke the earned income tax credit. If that's a phrase you hear a lot, but you're not entirely sure how it works, or you want to learn more about, you know, different perspectives on it, we're going to have a conversation next Wednesday at noon about the earned income tax credit. And we'll talk in more depth about why many economists, people like Kent Gardner, think that it's a pretty efficient vehicle and a pretty smart way to kind of handle things if you want to figure out who needs help, etc. But if you've got questions, we'll answer them next Wednesday. I want to thank Bill Maley, supervisor of the town of Brighton. Thank you, Bill, for making it work.
Thanks so much, Evan.
Scott O'Neill and Helen Davies. Thank you, Scott. I appreciate your perspective. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
And Helen Davies, good luck to you as well. I know it's sort of nervous times, but thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. We're back with you Friday on member-supported public radio.